Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators. And for the last 25 years, have worked with just about every major publisher and publication in the business. We've together published somewhere between 50 and 75 books. And we've all taught illustration at the university.
Each week, we pick a different topic in illustration and say very interesting things about it.
Great. We don't argue or agree.
We do sometimes argue.
Not anymore.
No, you know what? We never. I'm going to stop saying that because we really haven't argued enough.
We make an argument.
We make an argument, but we seem to agree with each other because a lot of these things are super obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah. We might want to
have. Well, we do have different, sometimes different perspectives, though not disagreements.
We should have a fight episode.
Yeah. Sometimes we have 2-point perspectives.
That's true. 1-point perspective is what it really is.
Yeah. Sometimes you're on your own. Yeah. I'm out of town right now on a laptop, and I don't have my good microphone.
What city are you?
That I brought. Surprise, Arizona. I always want to say Sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
And then if my wife looks at me weird, I'm like, did I just say Sunrise, Arizona?
No, Surprise.
What? Surprise. And I heard that the story behind Surprise is that the governor said that this area would never develop and called it Surprise because it would be a surprise if it ever turned into anything. And it's like thriving right now. Like it's,
yeah, that's a nice
surprise.
Location.
Is that a suburb of Phoenix?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like an hour outside of Phoenix, maybe.
Surprise. Maybe I've never heard of that.
Yeah, maybe 45 minutes. I always thought it was like you're driving through the desert. There's nothing but like cactus, and then surprise, here's a town. You're like, whoa.
That's pretty good.
So, all right, so
you'd be wrong.
We've had some questions come in over the last few months, and sometimes I answer these like via email. I just reply back to them, but sometimes, you know, I just put them in a folder, like maybe we could discuss this on the podcast. So today I thought we'd tackle some of these. I want to get some of you guys' thoughts on these and see what you think. So should we do it?
Let's go.
Let's do it. Okay. This is from Beth. She says, I recently had an offer to illustrate a children's book for a small publisher. Now this is kind of long, so I'm going to go through the situation.
Wait, quick pause there. Are we okay with using the name? I thought you said you were going to...
This person asked for this to be answered on the podcast.
Oh, okay.
That's cool.
I just want to be sure.
I believe. Anyways, I won't use the full name just to be safe.
Yeah, that's what I do, the first name.
If the person gets nervous about it, it's a different Beth, not you.
Yeah. So she said, I recently had an offer to illustrate a children's book for a small publisher. I'll spare you all the details, but here I'm going to dig into all the details. I was offered a significantly lower rate than I've ever worked for, yet I loved the story and wanted to experience working with this company. I even did some free spec work for the main character design, which I don't usually do. Any red flags so far, guys?
Or
does this sound okay? Sounds okay? No? Some red flags? All right. They took a month to actually send me the contract after asking me to do the project. In the meantime, I was approached by 3 other self-publishing authors, each willing to pay around twice the amount of the first offer. Okay, so she's sitting here. She really wants to work on this story. She wants to work with this publisher. And while she's waiting for them to send a contract, she's getting all these offers for this other thing. So she says, I told the publishing company that I had these other much higher paying offers on the table, yet I had made a verbal commitment to do their project and I would need more time allotted for the due date. But I said I would be happy to work with them anyway. Oh, also the contract had a very low cancellation fee. This sounds like a deal getting worse and worse.
Yeah.
I asked about that point, especially considering how unstable the economy situation is with COVID, and all they offered was a very, very low cancellation fee of a few hundred dollars, even if I were to complete the entire project. Mm. When I questioned these things and asked for a compromise, the publishing company told me I was being unprofessional to ask for more time, and even mentioned that I had higher paying offers. Someone's being unprofessional here.
Yeah.
They told me it was my personal business to manage my time, schedule my clients, and none of their concern. Also, it was not industry standards to include any higher of a cancellation fee. Then they ghosted me and never contacted me again as to whether they were willing to move forward with my contract. I was happy to move on to the higher paying opportunities, but I am confused. So that's the situation, and here's the question. Is it really unprofessional to mention that you have higher offers on the table or that you'll need more time, or to ask for a fair cancellation fee? Can an illustrator do these things, or are they breaking some unspoken rule of courtesy? What do you guys think about that?
This is I love questions like this because there's no right or wrong answer. There's a lot of nuance here.
Yeah.
And I think I would probably not say I have higher offers on the table, but I don't think it's unprofessional to at all say, hey, I have other opportunities that are presenting themselves right now. And as an illustrator, I have to keep my plate full. I have to keep my schedule full to maintain a certain income and basically piss or get off the pot. I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like, come on, you're holding up. You're holding me up, and I don't want to commit. I've given you first right of refusal, but I don't want to commit until I know something. And I don't think that's wrong, but I think it, I don't know. What do you think, Lee? Could it be manipulative to say I've got higher offers?
I think it's, for lack of a better term, a little crass to say it that way. How I would phrase that is my going rate is this. You don't have to
higher, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to say that's lower than my rate because, you don't have to threaten them with another offer that's higher.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because that means that you're charging a variable rate based on whatever the jobs are that you happen to be being offered at that time, right?
Right.
If that was the highest offer, then you take it? No.
But I think it's a good negotiation, like a negotiating tactic you would use in like, a job offer, like if you were working a day job and you got this higher job offer, you'd go to your boss and say, hey, I got this job offer. They want to pay me this amount. I'm wondering if you can match that. Otherwise, I'm going to take this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like a fair way to go. And I don't know, wouldn't that be okay in this situation too?
Yes.
I think it would be what I want to highlight is, or what this whole thing highlights actually is how reluctant illustrators are made and artists are made to feel about talking about money, mm-hmm. right? That whole reaction is basically shut up. Don't say anything. You can't compare costs. You can't ask for more. I mean, that's what it's really saying. Just permeates our industry. Don't talk about the money. Don't say what you need. Don't say what other people are getting. Don't say what the standard is or an average is. I mean, when can we talk about it?
Right. No, that's a really good point. I think we're kind of settled on that. Like it's okay to talk money, to say I need more money. You could decide whether or not you want to say you have other offers, but I like the idea of, well, this is my rate and they can't argue with that. Like that's your rate. You've been paid for that. Then that's what they're going to have to do. What about to ask for a fair cancellation fee and say, hey, you know, we could do this, but I need, you know, 50% or something. What is a fair cancellation fee?
I think fair is 100%.
Kill fee is 100%.
And here's the, Why would someone in no other walk of life would you be able to say, hey, I need a pool in my backyard. Will you come and dig the hole? But if I decide not to have the pool, I'm not paying you. I mean, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you decide, I didn't like how you fixed my toilet. You know, I'm just going to We're going to do a kill fee. I'll pay you $10.
If you ask me to do the work, you have to be prepared to pay for it.
Whether you use it or not, it's not our concern. Now, if there's a quality issue, that's a different story. So I do want to make that clear. What a kill fee is when the publishing side of it falls through. When the client side of things falls through. Hey, this isn't going to be printed anymore. Or we got bought by another company and aren't going to do this title, something like that. A kill fee is not, hey, you didn't deliver what you're supposed to. That's a totally different issue, and the pay is completely different.
Right. Because to protect the publisher, sometimes the illustrator doesn't come through. We're not perfect, you know. I mean, I am, but you guys aren't. And so it's obvious that you guys are going to screw up sometimes. And so the publisher needs to be protected, and they need to be able to not have to feel like they have to fork out 100% of the money for something they can't use at all because it's substandard.
Right.
I've never heard of that actually happening, where the illustrator doesn't deliver what they're supposed to, and so they have to give the money back or something like that, or don't get really paid rare at all. It's super, super rare. Yeah. But I have heard of many projects being killed after the entire thing is made.
Right.
And so that's why you just got to really, and what I say is it's 100% for wherever the project is at that point. Say if you're all the way through the sketch phase and it gets killed at that point, well, you're paid through the sketch phase. You're not paid the entire budget, obviously, if you haven't done the paintings yet. But if you have already done all the paintings, a kill fee is the full deal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I will say this. There's another thing that's happening in with this question, and it's, I think it's needs to be compared to a large publisher. There's large, medium, and small publishers. And large publishers, every experience I've ever had with a large publisher, it goes like this. We are so tickled that you are going to say yes and illustrate this book. We are so happy to have you. And we're honored to have you. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't mean that. I'm not saying that illustrators, we should expect to have our feet washed and kissed and everything like that. But
that's part of my contract, actually.
But the treatment, the sentiment is they're happy you said yes. And the feel that I got from this letter was, I think the red flag is whenever you feel like, if a client is trying to make you feel like you're beneath them,
or you're lucky to be able to work with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then that's a relationship that's started on manipulation, you know, and to start off balance like that, where, and they might not even think they're manipulating. They might actually feel like that. Well, I'm paying the money, so I am above you. It's a collaboration, right? Mm-hmm. It's a collaboration. And if you feel off balance like that, just know, if anything, the small publishers should be bending over backwards to make you feel great that they're able to work with you.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Our budget isn't great. Our kill fee is terrible. I'm so thankful that you're on board. That should be the tone.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it's often the other way around where they just don't get it.
But haven't you guys found that the lower the income or the lower the offer and the smaller, not necessarily the smaller publisher, I'm trying to think of how to say that. I've just had better luck with the bigger I go, the more they understand how it all works. And the smaller I go, all the way down to self-publishing requests, they don't understand how it works at all. And you get that kind of weird stuff.
Yeah.
When really, like as a small publisher, one of the things you can offer is like 100% attention, you know, like we're going to push this book out. We're going to put everything behind it. You know, we're only publishing 5 titles this year or 10 titles this year. And so you're going to get a lot of attention in getting this book out. But, you know, as opposed to a large publisher who's doing 1,000 books every year, so I don't know. They do, they do tons.
That's right.
Look at those catalogs.
Right.
And sometimes small publishers can actually beat large publishers with certain titles. Like I know Zach Retz did Too Much Glue for a tiny publisher, and they were able to market it. I don't know. I even asked him, like, what did they do like, why is your book ranking so high on Amazon? Because it was killing it. Mm-hmm. You know, for at least a year, it was killing it. He's like, I have no idea, but something they're doing to market this thing from a tiny publisher. So definitely not saying you should not work with tiny publishers, but there are red flags to...
And as long as they're willing to... I'm sorry, Jake, I don't want to cut you off. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the other thing with the tiny publisher is you get an opportunity. Usually you have a little more freedom and the subject matter is a little more... less broad and a little more narrow. Like, you could do stuff that a big publisher might not touch. Like, oh, that market's too small for us. Mm-hmm. But you could, you know, like a lot of these Christian markets, you know, they're small publishers and they do great in, you know, church bookstores and stuff like that. Or what was it? The Fart Dog, the Farting Dog book.
Yeah. You
know? Like, I don't know if that was self-published, wasn't it?
No, it was a small publisher, but they took over. It was in every gift shop. I mean, it was just so provocative at the time.
Yeah.
Everyone thought of doing a farting book, but no, everyone was like, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, and then someone Simon finally Schuster's did it. Simon Schuster's not going to release a book about a farting dog.
Right.
Also, speaking of that, if you got a small publisher that does have that attitude that you guys are saying, that, hey, we're going to promote this all over the place as best we can, we're going to give it all this attention, you know, that's... the other side of that is the negotiation side of it, because this person who wrote this letter was really concerned about the low budget, and maybe there's some self-published authors that are going to pay a little bit more. The second I have that scenario, then I start going back to the publisher saying, hey, let's look at the royalty, because all of a sudden that becomes a deal. Like, oh, you can't offer me that much off the front end, but well, double my royalty rate. And then they're talking all this promotion and stuff. That could be a huge win for you down the road. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're have a greater incentive to be a part of that marketing and selling too, as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember early on in my publishing career, my first book, I was like, oh, I'm with a major publisher. I'm with Scholastic. They've got a team of marketers. They've got like the book fairs. I just get to sit back, relax, and let them sell the book, right? And I wish I would have taken a more active part in it and a little more ownership of it, because I think I could have helped. You know, I could have done a little bit more than just doing a couple podcasts, you know, a couple books.
The problem there, though, is you have to earn real income, and that is a loss leader, maybe, or just a loss. I mean, it's great for the book in general, but it doesn't equal actual dollars per se in your pocket. And so I would love to do a self-funded, you know, tour of the U.S. and show up in every bookstore and sell it. So I have a book coming out in November, and I'm going to do the same thing I always do, which is nothing, because it doesn't work. I need to move on to the next project, because you're basically marketing for free at that point. I got to pay my bills.
Yeah.
Right. Hey, what's one more thing on this? What's the difference between a self-publisher and a small publisher?
I don't know.
I'll answer that. The small publisher published more books. They were once right. Their first book was they were a self publisher.
Yeah.
And being serious, so the thing for me is I would rather probably in most cases work for a little bit less and work for a small publisher because I can look at their website and see that at least they've published books before.
Yeah.
You know, if someone contacts me and said, hey, I have a great idea, let's make a book together, and they've never gone through the process, yikes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, also the difference is just the word self. I mean, that's the difference between a self-publisher and a publisher. If the person has only done a book that they wrote, that is a huge red flag for me. Right. I mean, I would always rather go to a small publisher as long as they didn't promote their own books. Because they're actually doing it, you know, they're working with writers, they're working, getting it printed, like you're saying. And there's it might not be a huge title list, but at least there is a title list. It's not just, hey, here's the one book that I came up with, and I printed 500, 50 copies at Kinko's. That's scary.
I think too, like, if you're gonna go the self-publishing route, just do it yourself. Like, spend the time to make right. something that's completely 100% yours
yep.
And go self-publish it instead of, you know, learning with someone else how to do this. All right. Next question. This comes in from Dean. He says in episode 59, what to do after college at 35:14. So he's really taking notes here on these episodes at minute 35 and 14 seconds. Will mentions that he wished he had kept a journal recording when he learned certain artistic principles during his work at BYU. I do something similar when I have a creative idea, whether it's an illustration, animation, sculpture, etc. I track when and where I am and what sparked the inspiration. What do you think of this as a habit for an artist? What do you guys think? Will?
My wife distracted me.
You were listening.
This is all about Will. Will's the one that said it.
Thanks a lot, honey.
All right, we gotta repeat it for Will.
Okay, Will, you said in episode 59 that you wished you had kept a journal when learning certain artistic principles during BYU.
Yeah.
So this guy says he does something similar, but what do you think of this habit for an artist? Like, should you record in a journal? Today, I learned light and shadow, you know, specifically what a bounce light does or
not. Yeah, there's probably a lot of value as a teacher, I would have loved to be able to look back at that and kind of piece mm-hmm. together, do a little archaeology on how I learned things, you know, mm-hmm. and when I learned them so that I could maybe even tell stories about how I learned them. As far as making great art, I don't know how important that is, mm-hmm. but I also think maybe for your own personal appreciation in your own learning or the people that you've been taught by, just writing down the number of things that you've learned. I mean, we were talking about this the other day, mm-hmm. that when you make an image, you're drawing on probably hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of information that you've learned to be able to do it. And you're not thinking right. about all those. They just right. are happening automatically.
What do you think, Lee?
I love the idea, and I would go farther. I think there's a benefit to any time you have to reduce a principle down to a couple of sentences or a paragraph or something like that. You have to condense it. So you have to really know, you have to really think about what that principle is saying to put it into words. You know, that's the beauty of teaching, I think, actually, too, is to, in order to explain something, you have to distill all this stuff down into some cognitive or you know, cohesive idea.
Yeah.
And so that's great. And so I would take that one step further. What helped my teaching quite a bit and helped my students as well is coming up with labels for a principle. Like I have the Mary Grand Prix principle of composition. Mm-hmm. And that means a certain thing to me. Like I've grouped like four or five different things under that header, and it's easy to grab that kind of stuff. The technique in perspective, exploding the vanishing point, which means something very specific. And so, you know, and you can come up with whatever labels you want to. But if you label it, all of a sudden you'll remember it versus trying to remember, okay, what does bounce light do? You know, or these, you know, unconnected ideas.
I think I'm going to, I don't know that this is, like Will was saying, like how applicable this is to like your daily professional, you know, life as an artist. Like, I'm not going back through journals looking for specific principles I learned. In fact, before I moved to Arizona, it's packing up, I had all these flat files full of like lecture stuff that I taught at BYU, lecture art that I made for SVS, and I just chucked them in the trash. I'm like, I already taught this. I just threw it all away. So I think what's kind of valuable is keeping sketchbooks where you could see the process, see your progress, and going back and looking at old sketchbooks and saying, oh, I clearly did not know light and shadow at this point. And with all my sketchbooks, I date them. So I I put a date at the beginning when I start the sketchbook, and then when I finish the sketchbook, I put the date that I finished it. Some people actually put dates on each drawing. That might be helpful too. I don't know. So that's kind of interesting just to see what, you know, the progress, because it is a good reminder and it's, it boosts your like confidence knowing, oh yeah, I've come a long way. And I love looking at old stuff and seeing how far I've come in my art. I think if you someday want to teach, you want to do a how to draw book, you want to do YouTube videos teaching, you know, art principles, then keeping a journal of how you learn stuff is probably going to be helpful as a teacher. But outside of that, I don't think...
You just kind of take the knowledge with you. I don't think you need to really formalize it so much. Let me ask you guys a peripheral question with this. I've always had this dilemma too. If you're creating traditional art, this doesn't really apply to everybody who's just straight digital, but if you're creating traditional art, you know, you have paintings that you like and that are, you know, good for where you are at the time. And then there's paintings that are, that as you get better, once you get to the, I think the pro level, you're going to have bad paintings that you don't love, but other people would love. And so once I, as I've moved from different house to house and state to state, I have accumulated all these paintings. And they were good enough at the time for to go in the magazine or whatever they did, but I don't want people to have them. So I end up throwing them away, like hundreds and hundreds of paintings. And then I get people that are mad at me that, oh, I'd love to have this painting. And then in my mind, I'm like, I don't want you to have this. I don't want this painting to go on the wall because I'm not really that happy with it. What do you guys recommend there? Do you throw away the old paintings that you don't like, or do you give them to people and just say, well, I don't really like this one, but I hope, you know, knock yourself out. I hope you like it.
There are paintings that I've thrown away too, because I don't want to see them on a friend's wall. I don't want to see them ever again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I threw out one full dumpster. I mean, 100 paintings, and some of them were big. And I went out the next day. This was in, honestly, we were leaving California, and I went out the next day and all the paintings had been taken, but the garbage hasn't been taken yet. So somebody's got all these paintings that I was trying to throw away.
Have you checked eBay?
I did. I did actually have a bunch of paintings that were being sold on eBay. Get this. I had done an event and I brought a bunch of paintings to show. I mean, just a ton of them, just passed them out, you know, like you do. And people are kind of looking them over. And a group of like, I think like 10 paintings from that lecture went up on eBay.
Oh man. They didn't come back to you after.
Somebody pocketed them during the lecture.
That's funny. Yeah. I feel the same way as you guys. Like there's some art that shouldn't be seen anymore. Right. Like, it's not doing anybody any favor being on a wall. Right. But on the other hand, there are some that are just good enough, even though I'm like, I would have done this so much different now, that, like family members have, you know, that they hang up, they have on their walls. I've given some of these away. I don't do a ton of original painting or I used to do, you know, 20 years ago or whatever.
Your stuff is more on paper. So it's more transportable. It's smaller. Yeah. I mean, one of my paintings that I threw away was like 4 feet by 8 feet. You know?
Yeah. Huge. What do you do with that?
Wow. Just put it by the dumpster and let somebody come get it. I guess.
All right. You guys want to do another one?
Sure.
No.
Okay. No. I disagree. We're going to do one. Okay. So this one, I'm just going to summarize it. This guy wants to know, he says, many artists say you should create the work that you want to do. So you want to get paid for something, you should be making that. And I totally agree with that. So his question is, he says, I want to make art for podcasts. Like, I want to be the guy that people call up. They want art for their podcast. And I want to do that. So his question is, how do I go about getting that work? Like, do I do spec work or fan art work for different podcasts and be like, hey, look at what I did. And the dilemma there is that, when he does something like that, then that podcast gets that art for free. And our other podcasts going to notice that. The other question is podcast illustration too narrow of a like market to go after. So this is just something that was kind of thrown at me. I ended up emailing this guy back and giving him my answer, but I'm curious what you guys this. Do you, in trying to get clients for a future project, do you do art, you know, specifically for somebody, tag them, post online, tag them, say, look what I did, in the hopes that you get hired? Or is there other ways, better ways to do that?
That's an interesting...
I'll go first because you're going
to
be wrong.
I'll wait to give the real answer. Go ahead, Will.
You only have so much time in a day to... you only have so much time in a day. So there's lots of work out there that you can go after. And I know that we hire our contest winners from the Critique Arena to illustrate our podcast. I'm not aware of that market and how many podcasts have artwork for each episode, but that I think it's definitely worth researching. And I think that if you found that, you know, if you went to each podcast and went to their website and you saw that they were having a photo or some sort of art for each podcast, or even if you thought maybe they should or they could, and you wanted to do one for free, there's a lot of ways to get work, and doing a free sample is not a bad way. Say, this is what I could do for your podcast or for your website. Here's a free one. If you want me to do more, this is how much you charge. And just do a bunch of those and see if there's a market there. Maybe there is. I wouldn't know. But I question the idea of I want to do podcast art. As the first part of the question was, we should do the kind of art that we want to do. Well, the market, the end use doesn't dictate what the art is, right? So make the art that you want to make and then go to the markets that could use it and try to sell it there.
Yeah.
But you didn't wake up thinking that you just had to illustrate podcasts. What about people that live before podcasts?
Right.
Well, that was exactly where I was going to go with it too, is you know, the logical extension of that is book covers and theater posters. And I mean, every town who has a children's museum or children's play kind of thing uses these theater posters. And book covers are one of my favorite gigs of all time. I mean, so the you know, podcast illustration takes up the exact same real estate. It's just a single image with some type on it. So I would say broaden those horizons and include the podcast too. But go after some more lucrative stuff. You don't want to go after the one niche that doesn't pay anything.
Yeah. One thing you got to understand with podcasts is like 5 podcasts make a lot of money and the rest of them, I think everybody's doing it for like to either they enjoy it and they want to give back, or it's to like promote something that they're part of, you know? And that's, in our case, that's our thing. Like, I don't know how much money this podcast actually makes. I know we spend a lot of money on this podcast and we do enjoy it. Like, this is probably one of the best things. One of my favorite things to do is hang out
with this podcast. Probably barely makes $5 million a year.
I know. It wouldn't be nice if we could just get over 5 million.
No, we don't make anything. We do this for free.
You notice we don't have advertisers like paying us for slots on this podcast. If anything, hopefully someone signs up for SVS and we get paid that way. But at the end of the day, we're making stuff for SVS and the people are paying for that. And so this podcast is really just kind of like advertising. But podcasts aside, you want to, you know, I like the idea, like book covers are the same kind of thing. Posters are the same kind of thing. One thing you can do is look at who has money to like burn, right? What careers have extra money? Who are the people buying boats? Who are the people buying sports cars? Who are the people buying like cabins and timeshares and stuff like that, right? What kind of professions are they in? And what kind of art do they want on their walls? And that might be something to look at. Like, I bet, you know, a podiatrist, right? These guys work on feet all the time. If you did a series of like amazing foot illustrations, every one of them would want them like a print of it on their wall, right? You just figure out, you know, do a Google search, podiatrists in California, podiatrists in Arizona, and just kind of work your way across the country, find their emails, make an email list, send them out. I sell these prints. Or maybe you do cartoons, foot cartoons, a bunch of foot puns, turn them into like a cartoon. They'd want that framed and put on the wall somewhere. Dentists,
can I do my dad, since somehow this podcast walked right into my dad joke that I embarrassed my kid with. Can I do my
yeah,
dad
you
joke?
Can. You might as well.
I'm going to give you guys some life advice. You can never have defeat without delegs.
So do an illustration of that. Contact your local podiatrist.
So stupid.
What's funny is, this is kind of tangential off of this. I knew a guy who rented a helicopter. This is before drones. Rented a helicopter, got a camera, and flew around like $1 million neighborhoods, like houses with million, $2 million, $3 million houses. And he just took photos of all the houses from different angles. And then he went door to door and said, "Hey, would you like a photo of your house?" And he was selling photos, like nice photos of the house. You know, if you want, I can get it framed for you and come back. And people are like, "Oh, that's kind of cool." This is before, you know, Google Maps, right? And you could see it from, you know, no one would see their house from that angle. There's tons of way to like be creative and make money. And I think you start at the top and kind of work your way down. And at the end, you can try and make money off of podcasts.
All right. Because podcasts just don't make all a ton of money.
Yeah.
Okay. I have one more and then we'll end it with this one. This comes from an illustrator who, and I replied to her as well. And I thought it was such an interesting situation because, you know, who knows who else is in this situation. Maybe we could help. So this person, they titled their email, accidentally became an illustrator, help. And essentially what she's done is she has had no formal training as an illustrator. And her style is pretty simple, you know, a couple steps up of like stick figures, but they're all done with care and they're done with, you know, some rendering, and you look at it and you don't think, oh, that's super primitive. You just think, oh, that's kind of cute. Right. But what's really unique about her illustrations is the subject matter and the voice that she has behind it. And you can see it and you think, okay, obviously this person isn't a trained illustrator, but what they're creating definitely has value. And she's built a following online and she does these great posts that are kind of endearing. And it's something you would send, you know, to a friend, like if they're feeling bad one day, you'd send this image and it would cheer them up, or, you know, maybe it would make them laugh or something like that. So she asks, the question is this, she keeps getting like these job offers of people who like, well, maybe you could do a children's book, or maybe you could illustrate a card, or maybe you could, you know, do, you know, whatever. These clients see this and they want her to do it. She is, I think, having some imposter syndrome. Her question is, should she be accepting these exciting new jobs even though she doesn't have any essential drawing skills or a solid portfolio? And she says, am I putting people's work at risk by creating unskilled work? Like, she doesn't want a children's book to go out into the world and it clearly, you know, could be, you know, essentially someone could say, oh, a hack did this, you know, this isn't a real illustrator.
So is she basically saying that she's got imposter syndrome?
She didn't say that, but
that's kind of where she's going.
I think that's what's going on here, is a little bit of that. So what do you guys think is the solution here? Should she get some formal training and kind of add that to this the style that she has, or should she just not worry about it and keep barreling down, you know, the path that she's on? Should she turn down these offers?
She should definitely get more training, probably. Have you seen her work? Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. saying that doesn't help her today, you know, doesn't help her with current offers and isn't going to help her for a while, because it takes a while to get to the point where you can learn what you need to learn. I mean, it takes years. So
mm-hmm. I'd be careful with that. I am going to argue.
Okay. Let's hear it.
We finally have something to disagree on.
Yeah.
Training is a little bit of a trap in a way. Like say you have like a folk art kind of style. The only mm-hmm. thing you can do is keep going in that direction to enhance that style. If mm-hmm. you go say you have a folk art style, it's pretty cool. And then you go into a regular training mode. Now you're going to learn 2-point perspective. You're going to learn mm-hmm. about stroke weight and all this stuff. You are going to be in a middle ground for an extremely long time.
Yeah.
And it's gross. Like the hybrid of that doesn't work at all. So if you do go to quote unquote training, it needs to be really specific. If you're already getting offers and some, obviously there's some interest in the work, you need to go down that road of enhancing what's already there, not a traditional training route.
Mm. Okay, but I have to argue back in that you don't know this person and you don't know their portfolio. So we have to give we're giving good general advice mm-hmm. to most people. But at the same time, if you were to look at this person's portfolio, you might give them specifically.
Very specific. Just be careful. If you have no training and you're all of a sudden getting work, you want to be careful about the kind of training you get. You can wreck what's actually nice about it.
Yeah, that's good advice. And we're not giving this particular artist advice, but if you find yourself in this kind of situation where you've developed a style and it's not grounded in any sort of fundamentals, I like how you said it, like a folk art style. Like that's kind of cool. My advice to her was, the hard part in art creating is figuring out what to create, like finding your voice, finding something to say with your art. Anybody can go through 4 years of art school, you know, take online tutorials. They can learn how to render a ball, you know, with light on it and bounce light and all that stuff. Anybody can do that, and they learn how to add texture and what colors go together. But what people are interested in with what she's creating is this voice that she has with her work. Like, she knows the thing to say, the words to say that go with the picture. She knows what picture to put to convey that message. And so my advice to her was keep doing what you're doing. And if you want training to kind of, like, say you want to add a little light and shadow to your stuff, or maybe a few better like design principles, big, little, small, stuff like that. Add that to it, but don't change like the ultimate voice of what you're doing.
Right.
And that does get sticky. I think you're right though. Like now they're doing 2D art, but with 3D rendering, and it turns into this weird like
right.
mishmash.
It's not folk art anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know,
it's a tough one.
Jake, you and I have a common friend, Sarah Jane Wright. Mm-hmm. And she went through this. Mm. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. So she, and she's an illustrator that had a really big following on Etsy. Mm-hmm. Selling, I believe,
probably
an average.
Still does.
Yeah, $3,000 a month. And this was like 10 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. In prints and little fun things that you'd hang in your kitchen and bathroom and stuff like that. And really kind of I hope I don't offend her by saying this, but kind of a brand that I would put similar to like a Holly Hobby kind of mm-hmm. a thing, but her definitely her own, not looking like Holly Hobby, but think of a brand like that where it's decorative.
It's decorative. It caters to, you know, a mom who wants to decorate a kid's room.
Right.
Yeah.
And an editor from, I believe, HarperCollins followed her on Etsy and thought, oh, she'd be perfect to illustrate this manuscript. Contacted her, asked her to illustrate it. She wasn't even planning an illustration career. She didn't go to art school. She didn't do anything. Huh. She's just kind of found herself all of a sudden attracting the publishing world, and came and checked herself into my class it was a workshop conference called Writing for Young Readers. And that's where I met her. And she was like, help. I'm coming at this backwards. I've gotten, a request from a publisher and I don't know what I'm doing, and we kind of worked and she kind of learned and picked up stuff over time. But I mean, that's what we're all doing in illustration. It's not, I would say in some fields like accounting, you go through accounting, go through business school, you go through accounting classes, and you learn how to work the software. You learn how to be an accountant, and you either can or you can't do it. To me, and there might be more nuance than that, I'm sure there are better accountants than others, and then of course you can get your CPA license. But in general, there are bookkeepers, and you can either keep the books or you can't. An illustration is never like that. It's not like one day all of a sudden now you can illustrate. Everything is easing into the deeper end over time. We all did that. And we all, our first books, that if I were to illustrate my first book today, it wouldn't look anything like my first book.
Right.
Yeah.
That's yeah. Right.
You know.
And what's cool with Sarah, she's gone on to do several children's books. Like her style, I think she's leaned in really hard on instead of overly rendering things, like really just letting her, her hand kind of like guide what the illustration's going to be instead of, something that's super developed and rendered and, I don't want to say like classical or something like that, but it's a style that very much reflects the whimsy and like the fun that she has. It's cool to see her like have grown over the years in that style too.
The one thing to talk about there though, with that kind of person is what's the advice you give them? Then? So, okay, go ahead and take none of us really know what we're doing, even though we've had some training, but go ahead and take the job, the illustration job. The danger that person runs into is they don't know what they don't know. And that's pretty much where the fear is coming from, right? Mm-hmm. They get an illustration job. They have to do a scene that is a, character in a hot air balloon looking down on a city. And they've never done that. And so they don't know how to approach that. And so I can understand the insecurity of us three, I pretty much know exactly how I would handle almost any illustration at this point, because we've done upshots and downshots and crowd scenes and all the water and smoke and all the stuff that's hard to draw over time, and you just sort of have to clumsily make your way through it. But, a new artist like that hasn't done that. So do you recommend they go for the client work and just say, hey, you're sort of the one in a million kind of thing, that where you got through, you have a voice already, and just go nuts? Or do you say maybe do a couple of personal projects, make sure you can get through them okay?
I kind of would. I didn't do a full children's book before I ever did a children's book.
I didn't either.
At some point you just have to here's what I'm doing, here's what I'm jumping in, I'm doing it. I've done finished illustrations, I'd done like short comics and things like that, but I think children's books are so specific in that it's 16 spreads, and sometimes it's more illustrations than that. It could be 32 illustrations or spot illos. There's all that stuff. Before you would take on a job like that, I would at least be comfortable doing the three different kinds of spreads you would do, or the three different kinds of illustrations you would do in a children's book. And that's the spot illustration, the one page, and the full page, right? And at least do a couple of those just so you know your process, you know how long it takes. Right. So you know how much time to like budget out for a project like that. As far as like training and stuff, it doesn't hurt to at least, if you've never had training, to at least like go through a fundamentals and just kind of see, you know, you might learn something that you didn't know with color theory, and you might learn something a little bit about like shape language and things like that, that it could, you know, affect yours. But I, you know, sometimes if you do a full art school program, you know, if you do a full program where you're maybe a mentorship with somebody, you're going to learn how to do the art that is the style that that school does, or that teacher does, or that mentor Correct. Does. Mm-hmm. And know that going in, that you spend 4 years, you know, or 2 years or whatever, focusing on doing that kind of stuff, it's going to affect your work. But I think if you take some online classes and you're still, you know, you're applying it to stuff you're already doing, it could, you know, boost your style and make it a little bit better.
I think. We do have a video that I'll recommend. Wait, did we do a podcast on how to find your style? I know we did a webinar back in the day, but I can't remember if we did.
I think there was an old episode back in 2018.
But you might want to check that out, because that's what I would recommend is okay, you got this style and this voice. Now find the other people who are doing that, but better. Like kind of your track, find your roadmap through those people, see what they're doing different, and maybe try out some of those techniques, and those colorways, and see if it applies to your work or whatever, and kind of custom make your own path.
Yeah. Go to episode 36. It's the style episode.
Yeah. Anyway. I don't think it hurts to learn, you know, all the fundamentals that you're missing either. I do think in the short term, it could goof with your, like if it is a folk art style. Why, I don't know, where did we settle on folk art style? Did she?
I just brought it up because typically folk art is, you know, you're there. It's just self-taught.
Like a one point perspective kind of a thing. And
it's just, yeah, it's clunky, but then it has a charm to it. And I think that's just why I thought of that style, but you know, I mean, some of that stuff is so cool. And the second you learn 2-point perspective, that style is hard. The folk art style is then hard to do,
right?
Because it's so clunky and kind of weird because you just don't know what you're doing.
Right.
Be careful.
There's not a one size fits all piece of advice here, I don't think. But in general, I think it's good to know as much as you can, because there are people who can do, you know, a classical painting style, who can also do a really primitive style and choose to.
I don't know anybody like that.
Perry, one of the teachers at UBU can ape any style, and he's good at it. He's good at all of them. Now, he's also a teacher, and that really helps in teaching. Doesn't necessarily help as much in a career if you're just doing illustration work. But I don't know. I feel like I look back. I used to think that my lack of drawing ability enhanced my style. That was the line that I fed myself, you know, because it's easy, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And I look back at that work and I don't like it. You know,
Yeah, but maybe you've been trained out of liking it.
Maybe.
Here's the difference, though, is like for all of us who've had regular training, how many of us with no training would have been hired to do anything? So what I get from this email, this question, is this person's a one percenter who happens to already have the thing that everybody else has to go train for. I mean, like musicians fall into that category, right? Who's the housewife on America's Got Talent, but The Voice, Suzanne Boyle?
Yeah.
And she just comes out of nowhere, no training, no anything, and she's just got this voice from heaven.
Yeah, she can sing opera, like the hardest thing to sing.
Right. And she nails it. So she just already has the thing that all the people going to Juilliard and these other music places are striving for. They have to pay for it. They have to struggle to get it. She already has it. And so she goes right into making her own album. She wouldn't send her to school. So this person, that's kind of where I go. I mean, I haven't seen this person's work, but that's kind of what I get from this, because I wouldn't have got hired without at least doing some kind of formal training. I had started to get a little bit of hints of that, but I just didn't know enough I didn't have enough style, I guess, in the beginning to not do it. But this person maybe does. So.
Okay. Well, let's wrap it up. Unless there's any anything else you guys want to say.
I don't want to say anything else, so I'm not going to.
Okay, great.
I will say this, that I asked Jake what the topic was today, and he said, it's just going to be three questions. And I was like, we're going to do a podcast with three questions. That'll be over in 5 minutes. But no, we filled another hour.
Yep.
Such a chatty, chatty people.
All right. Thanks for joining us, everybody. 3-Point Perspective is, as mentioned earlier, it's made possible by SVS Learn, where becoming a great illustrator starts. And today your hosts are Will Terry, Lee White, and I'm Jake Parker. Go to willterry.com. So you can find Will's portfolio there and check out his work. You can also follow him on Instagram at willterryart. Lee White's website is amazing. I was actually on there a couple days ago, just kind of poking around, checking stuff out. It's a lot of fun. His website is leewhiteillustration.com, and you can find his stuff at leewhiteillo on Instagram. My website is Mr.
Hold on, is my website amazing?
No.
Okay.
Need a little upgrade. Little upgrade.
I was actually on both y'all's websites.
I guess if you poke the bear, you're going to get...
I was on both of them. I just felt like Lee needed a boost, you know? He needed...
Oh,
thank you.
Lee, your website is amazing, by the way.
Thank you. Everybody go check it out.
A little down. You know, Will Terry's no slouch either. So go check out his online portfolio. My website is mrjakeparker.com. And you can follow me on Instagram at Jake Parker. Podcast is produced by Daniel Tu. And you can follow him along at daniel2.co. That's his website. Check him out there. Thanks for all the work that he does. He posts on Facebook. He posts it on the website. He gets it out to your podcast listening device. And lastly, all of our social media and everything is done by Lisa Fott, and just want to give a shout out to her and thanks for that. Is Lisa ever going to get a website? LisaFott.com? Who knows? All right.
Well, I always think whenever you say it's produced by Daniel too, I think Daniel also.
Yeah, I know.
Produced by Daniel too, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
Daniel as well. Daniel also. Listen, you
Hi,
guys,
Daniel.
If you like this episode, please share it around. That's all we ask. You could subscribe to us on your podcasting app that you use. If you're going to go that far and do that much, might as well leave a review. We love hearing what you think. And if you're actually wanting to join in on this discussion, you feel like we didn't answer these questions adequately enough, you know, we post this topic in the forum over at svslearn.com. And you can go there, and the forums are great. Everyone's nice. No one hates each other. We're all like, if it ever gets heated, it's respectful. Does it ever get heated?
It never does. It's a really supportive community. I don't know how that happened, because we didn't aggressively try to make it that.
Yeah.
It just somehow ended up with no trolls and all supportive. It's sort of a family now, really. It is.
It's Hakuna Matata.
So go over to the forum, check it out. We'd love for you to join us there. All right, that's it. Thank you, everybody, and we'll see you next time.